It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As state lawmakers weigh new mandates for testing evidence in sexual assault cases, we examine policy priorities of a nonprofit that advocates on behalf of survivors and agencies that provide victim services. Share your priorities. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ian Henderson is Policy and Systems Director for the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ian, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me again.
Good morning. So with the state budget coming together, what do you hope lawmakers do with state funding levels for victim services?
Yeah, well, I think it's really useful to talk about, with respect to state funding, kind of where we are in terms of funding of sexual assault services in Wisconsin as a whole, because that really, I think, puts into clarity the need for state funding. Right now, most funding of sexual assault victim services in Wisconsin is federal funding. And so the biggest source of funding is VOCA, or Victims of Crime Act funding. That's a little over $5 million a year going in to fund sexual assault services in the state in Wisconsin. And we know significant reductions are coming in that funding source. The way that funding is administered at the federal level, it's surcharge-based funding, meaning, right, that fines and fees associated with people or corporations convicted of federal crimes, those funds get deposited in a big pot of money called the Crime Victims Fund, which then get dispersed out to the states. And deposits have dropped in recent years. And so DOJ, Wisconsin DOJ, who administers that funding, back in 2018, there was a high of about $58 million. Well, that dropped to $18 million in 2021 and has leveled off around $24 million per year recently. So we know reductions are coming, and we were able to sort of hold off, and Governor Evers held off those reductions by allocating some American Rescue Plan funds. Mm. So that kind of stemmed the tide, but we know significant cuts are coming.
Governor Evers' budget, though, does establish additional grant programs for victim services. What do you see there as steps forward for survivors in the governor's budget as proposed?
Yeah, no, the governor makes a really significant investment in funding sexual assault services. And so we're really appreciative. And I think the need is really great based on what I've just talked about in terms of those reductions in federal funding. And so the state funding, which is the Sexual Assault Victim Services Program, right? That is state funding, it's state tax dollars. That's been static at a little over $2 million per year for the past probably close to a decade. And so with the reductions in federal funding, programs are really experiencing a dramatic need, right? So they're anticipating not only those reductions coming, but they are experiencing reductions in local funding sources. And so those, along with staffing constraints, right, that's creating barriers for services for survivors right now, right? And the need is really acute. And so the governor proposed increasing funding for the state Sexual Assault Victim Services Program by $5 million per year. So that's a really historic investment in sexual assault victim services funding.
Can we step back for just a moment? As you say, you anticipate these federal funding reductions coming. Why is that? Is that due to pandemic era or something else?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think what we have heard from our partners at the national level, right? As I mentioned, that VOCA funding is surcharge-based funding, right? It's not, so it's basically that pot of money depends on how much goes into it each year. And so I think there may be what we've heard anecdotally at the federal level is that under the previous administration, there was maybe a less emphasis on prosecuting white-collar crime. There might be, and those can often be associated with high fees and fines. And so just deposits were decreasing in recent years into that Crime Victims Fund, and that means there's less money available for states.
We're talking about legislative priorities of a Wisconsin group advocating for survivors of sexual assault. Ian Henderson is here from the Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You can join in with your questions and experiences and thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ian, you say that the need is acute. Where is it most needed? Where are those funding dollars most, you know, best spent and most needed?
Yeah, I think that sexual assault victim services grant program is really critical. It is a flexible source of funding, meaning programs can not only use that funding for direct services, but also prevention and education activities. Those activities are a little more limited with some of the federal dollars. So the SAVES program is really critical. And I think what programs are and survivors are experiencing are barriers to services, right? Most programs are saying the demand for their services is going up. At the same time, they're facing these funding restrictions, both at the federal and local levels. And so what we're hearing from programs is that there's waiting lists for critical services like counseling, therapy, and support groups. One program has reported in Wisconsin that the waiting list or the waiting time for therapy services in their community is 8 to 9 months for their clients.
Wow.
That's significant. And so also where programs are saying they're reducing their public out and awareness and support group activities, which again, right, if you're facing funding constrictions, it makes sense that programs are going to be prioritizing the direct services, but that has an effect, and they're able to do less public education and awareness activities.
I wonder, since a lot of the grant funding is filtered through the state justice department, how closely does your organization work with justice on services for victims?
Yeah, we work very closely with DOJ. I think, right, in addition to being the administrator of some of those important funding sources that we've just been talking about, WCASA has partnered with DOJ on really as a funder and as a technical assistance provider, our organization strengthening services and programs across the state. We also sit on the Attorney General's Sexual Assault Response Team, or AG SART, which is a multidisciplinary state-level team that's looking at improving criminal and medical system responses for survivors. So that includes some of the work we did with sexual assault kits that I know we've talked about in the past, but also looking at it, improving law enforcement training, resources for prosecutors. So I think that's another example of our real close partnership with the Department of Justice.
And how do providers of victim services demonstrate whether the services they're providing are effective, whether they are, that the return on investment is there, so to speak, because this is funding from tax dollars?
Right. No, it's a really good question. And I think we are really fortunate to have on our staff an evaluator. And so her name is Megan, and she is able to provide technical assistance to programs on their evaluation. Because you're right? That's an important, oftentimes deliverable, or that you're measuring what you're doing. And so we have to do that at a coalition, and we have a staff person helping us with that. But we're also able to provide that technical support to programs to help evaluate their services. And you're right, that is an important function. I mean, not only just for good stewards of tax dollars, but I think programs want to know how they're doing, right? And want to look at evaluating and modifying their services to really suit and meet the needs of survivors.
Ian Henderson, heads up legal and system services at the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault, join in on the work of advocating on behalf of survivors and the impact of victim services. Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We examine the policy work to stop sexual violence and programs to improve support for survivors and hold perpetrators accountable. Call in at any point in the discussion. The number to join in with your question is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ian Henderson is here, Policy and Systems Director at the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Ian, let's talk about sexual assault evidence kits. New laws in effect since last year are hoping to prevent the backlogs of sexual assault evidence from accumulating ever again. Are those laws achieving their goals so far?
Yeah, I think so. Excuse me. So far, I think what we're hearing is really positive things. And I think by putting in those specific requirements and time frames, right, that gives survivors and the people who handle those kits, whether that be forensic nurses or law enforcement who's collecting the kits, clear parameters on what they're supposed to do and in what time. And I think the other piece that's really important for survivors, not only having those expectations, but the creation of a kit tracking system, right, that allows them to anonymously in a time and place of their choosing to access information about where their kit is and where it is in the process. So I think those two things going hand in hand, really important to prevent a future backlog of kits, as you mentioned.
That barcode tracking system, it went live nearly a year ago, allowing, as you mentioned, survivors of sexual assault to log on to that database using a barcode and view the status of the kit as it goes through the process, the testing process. What have you noticed as a result of this system launch?
Well, I think, prior to the creation of a kit tracking system, right, a survivor was dependent on other people for accessing information. And I mean, and that's not unusual necessarily in terms of survivors who are navigating systems, right? To have to rely on other people to share information, right? And most of the time that's not a problem. But the benefit of the kit tracking system, right, is that that power is given to the survivor, right? They are able to, instead of having to pick up the phone or send an email and reach out and saying, "Hey, can you let me know where my kit is?" The survivor can do that at the time and place of their choosing. And I think, right, sexual violence at its root is about a loss of control, but someone taking control over someone's body, right, and violating their auto bodily autonomy in the most, really personal way. And so it may sound really small, but the ability for to restore control and to give a survivor the ability to access that information at a time and place of their choosing, right? That's part of restoring control back to a survivor.
If a survivor doesn't wish to report the sexual assault to law enforcement, that kit is still sent to the state crime lab and it's stored, as I understand, for a decade.
Correct.
How important is that?
Well, that's again when you talk about options, right? Another part about what we call trauma-informed response, right? Which is really, again, at its base is like, again, restoring some control back to that person. That option to have a kit collected, even if that person is not sure that they want to report at a particular time, right? They can have the evidence collected and it can be sent from the hospital to the crime lab where it'll be stored for, as you said, for 10 years, right? That gives that person time to change their mind if they want to or if they don't, right? But again, it's an option, right? And I think that's really important.
We've talked on our show about sexual assault nurse examiners, the shortage of these registered nurses who've completed this additional education to help survivors of sexual assault. What do you see there from nurse examiners, and do you see the shortage as well?
Sure. I mean, it's certainly something that we know survivors and programs who are supporting survivors are experiencing, right? Where same programs may close or curtail or restrict their hours. And so I think absolutely that has an impact on survivors. A survivor may have to travel 100 miles to get a forensic exam. And so I think that I know is a priority not only of the Attorney General Sexual Assault Response Team, but a priority of the Department of Justice, that the agency that really coordinates the sexual assault nurse examiner training. And I think, it's also looking at other models of forensic nursing. Are there more, and I know these are things that are being examined in the state, right? Mobile SANE services, looking at services outside of hospitals, right? I think the need and the challenges are well documented in terms of SANE sustainability of forensic nursing. So I think we've got to be looking at all options, whether and not just at those services being located at hospitals.
Do you see grant programs that help people, help victims be able to get the care they need, the health care they need? Is that a piece of the grants?
I mean, absolutely. So the funding for sexual assault victim services, right, that we started talking about this morning, really is funding for direct services to survivors. And those advocates, as the term we use in the field, well, the people who are working directly and supporting survivors, right, are trained to give survivors a range of options and to really be there to help them navigate the system. But really, the survivor is the one who's directing that, right? And so advocates can say, You can get a forensic exam and this person can collect evidence. You can just get your healthcare needs met. But right, that person being a kind of a first entry point, they're not always a first entry point. But if they are, right, they can offer those options for survivors and then help them navigate systems, right? And they're also confidential resources, which is really important.
We're talking about the policy and legislative priorities of a group that advocates for survivors of sexual assault. Ian Henderson is with the Coalition Against Sexual Assault. You can join in along the way and bring up your question. Call in at 800-642-1234. Ian, let's turn to the time it takes to process the kits. This year, lawmakers introduced bills that would establish deadlines for testing sexual assault evidence at state crime labs. One proposal would set a 60-day deadline, another a 90-day deadline. I understand your organization supports the 60-day deadline. Can you go into that?
Sure. Yeah, I think again, I mean, at a basic level, we're supportive of having a time frame for the crime lab to test sexual assault kits. It was kind of the one piece that was not included in the legislation we've been talking about, right? The time frames were really for when kits had to be collected by law enforcement and then sent into the crime lab. So the legislation, there's one bill that's passed the assembly, that's AB 36. That legislation was developed with Representative Steffen and Senator James and the Department of Justice, right? So it that legislation had was worked on with those respective entities, and I think because of that, we're supporting that. And I think the fact that it's passed the assembly is really helpful. I think what we've heard from other states and what we've heard from the crime lab is that a 90-day time frame without additional resources may not be feasible. Other states, what we've heard is that they've put in time frames that maybe did not have the resources allocated to meet that, and then that creates maybe heightened expectations for survivors that their kit will be processed in the time that it isn't feasible. And when we think about all the things the crime lab has to test, right, sexual violence is one of them, but there are a variety of crimes, including homicide and other things that, right, we want this to be an informed process. And I think we would be supportive of something like 90 days, but if what we're hearing from the crime lab is they feel they need additional resources, then we think that makes sense as well. So we just want to support legislation that is likely to be enacted, that creates a time frame that's realistic for survivors, and that makes sense for those who are having to to test the kits. And I think the legislation that passed the assembly earlier this spring, again, had that input from not only the legislature, but the crime lab and the Department of Justice.
Do you get the sense that the state crime labs are adequately staffed and funded to fulfill a 60-day deadline?
Yeah, I would have to, defer to the DOJ and crime lab on that one. I don't want to speak for them. I think the fact that, right, that legislation and the amendments that were included and that were passed reflect the input of the Department of Justice. So I think I'll leave it at that. But I don't want to speak for the crime lab in terms of what they feel in terms of their adequate resources. I think this, again, reflects that kind of compromise approach.
And so, if we do see something like this in state law, what happens if the state fails to meet its deadline, be it 60-day or 90-day?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I don't know that there's a I don't think in the legislation there's any sort of penalty or any
Penalty.
sort of
Okay.
consequence. I think, right, for survivors that would create, I think this, disappointment is probably a mild
Sure.
word, but like sort of deflated expectations, right? A feeling like they were told something was going to happen in a certain time and then that didn't happen, right? And I think that could lead to some survivors feeling like the system isn't working for me. And so I think that's why you want time frames that feel realistic and that are resourced. Again, I think from a 90-day perspective, we would be fine with that. But if what we're hearing is the crime lab doesn't feel they can do that without additional resources, then that would be the tension there, I think.
We only have about 20 seconds left here, but aside from direct funding of victim services, what other parts of the state budget are you monitoring that could affect survivors?
Yeah, I think, there's a whole range of things. We were, paid family leave came out. I mean, that has absolutely a way to benefit survivors. That was disappointing that was pulled out. Also pulling out the funding for the missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives. Native and Indigenous women experienced sexual violence rates at some of the highest rates in the population, and so we were disappointed to see those things be pulled out. So, but we're, we try and take a broad view of about of how and the resources and the supports for survivors. And so, while we're focusing particularly on sexual assault victim services, we're monitoring a wide range of things in the budget.
Ian, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me this morning.
Ian Henderson, Policy and Systems Director at the Wisconsin Coalition Against Sexual Assault. This is a State Capitol Report. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the governor and the legislature strive to enact the state budget bill by the end of next month, we check in on how budget negotiations are going in Joint Finance, the influential 16-member budget writing committee. Call in with questions and thoughts about the state budget, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Evan Goyke is a Democratic state representative from Milwaukee, member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Representative Goyke, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, let's get a pulse on how budget negotiations are going. How would you characterize how Joint Finance Committee is working right now?
Well, we started with a flurry on May 2nd, and since then we've been working our way through some smaller state agencies. And last week, we tackled some important issues that actually had some bipartisan support. And this week, you're going to see the two parties really diverge. And, tomorrow, we start talking about the Department of Workforce Development, and that includes a lot of discussion about workers' rights and labor conditions. And you'll see the two parties, like I said, diverge there. And we really get heated as we roll into June and take on some of the biggest issues in the state budget, like public education and healthcare and taxes. That'll really define the month of June's debate.
Do you feel you're on track to meet the budget deadline?
Yeah, I think that the two co-chairs have announced that we will be on time. I get a sense there's some fractures between the Senate and Assembly. That always happens. For example, on Thursday, we had a long delay before we actually began debate on the Department of Natural Resources budget. And when there's that long delay, that's usually fighting between the Senate Republicans and Assembly Republicans. But they have signaled that we're on track, and I think we are so far to meet that June 30 deadline.
On Joint Finance, two-thirds of the committee is Republican. Do Democrats on the committee like yourself feel heard?
Sometimes. I mean, we do our best to make sure that we're heard. Sometimes that means we turn the volume up. Sometimes that means we work together between the four of us members to make sure that we are, really hitting points home. That is always a difficult question to answer because we are outnumbered 12 to 4. And you hear that number a lot, that we lose a motion 12 to 4 or that the majority's motion is adopted 12 to 4. But yeah, I think the four of us, Democrats, work very closely together. I think we've got a really great team with different backgrounds and skill sets, and so far have complemented one another to ensure that each day the major topics of the day and the kind of counter argument to the majority party is effectively made.
Well, let's take a call about the historic surplus before the state. John in Boaz is here. John, hi, what's on your mind?
I would like to know if your experts can tell you how much interest are we gaining with the $5 billion surplus, cha-ching, cha-ching, cha-ching.
So as the surplus sits there, John wonders, what is the interest accumulation there?
Well, it's a great question, John. There should be some interest. I don't have a hard number for you. What I can tell you is what we talk about this surplus as being a cash balance at the end.
Representative Goyke, are you still there? We're having trouble hearing you. I think we just lost Representative Evan Goyke, Democratic member of the legislature's budget writing committee. You can join in with your questions as we talk about the state budget. Call in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We're going to get into the shared revenue in just a moment here. Representative Goyke, can you hear us?
I'm here. I can hear you.
Okay, good, good. Well, I want to turn to shared revenue now. Last week, Assembly Republicans announced several changes to shared revenue plan. And then hours later, an amended bill was passed. How do you feel about the negotiations that took place ahead of voting?
Well, I was disappointed that we didn't see more collaboration before the vote. I remain optimistic that there will be changes made in the state Senate. This is such a critical issue and such a critical bill for every single Wisconsinite. It is too important to be locked in a partisan stalemate. And I'm hopeful that we get something done, that it's a final product that both sides can agree on. And as mentioned, it delivers needed aid to every single corner of the state. So this is something we've got to get right. We can't let it go down in a partisan stalemate. So I'm optimistic.
So the Republican shared revenue plan says almost all local governments would receive at least 15% in existing county and municipal aid. Governor Evers proposed 10%. Which plan do you support?
Well, the question is not whether or not I support delivering that aid or that relief. It's whether or not that aid comes with strings attached and what those strings are. So my objections to the bill passed last week in the Assembly were the conditions applied to local governments that receive aid, specifically the community that I live in and represent, Milwaukee County, where a number, maybe even a dozen different policy initiatives were attached to the bill. And frankly, many of them do not speak to the budget of the city or the county. Two of them involved public education and schools. And I feel it's not appropriate to attach that degree of strings to the bill.
Right, because the legislation includes, as you mentioned, a list of requirements for local governments to meet. What in particular do you see problems with? Which policies in particular? I mean, one was maintaining a level of law enforcement. Another was no money for diversity, equity, and inclusion type staffing. Which in particular are you concerned about?
Well, I think that second piece that you hit, the diversity, equity, inclusion, is a major challenge for me. I represent a majority-minority district in the Assembly. And it's a broader issue than just that policy. It's about self-governance. It's about the autonomy of local elected officials being able to use tax dollars, my property tax dollars, the way we elect them to do. So it's broader than just one piece like DEI. There were changes at the last minute about how that law enforcement and fire funding, what we call a maintenance of effort, the level of funding necessary for local governments in those areas. And I think that change was a positive step in the right direction, but we still have to address many of the policies that are specific to Milwaukee.
What about part of the plan that includes going to referendum for Milwaukee or Milwaukee County, asking voters to support, a sales tax increase? What do you see there?
I find it to be a challenge. I think voters in Milwaukee have endorsed in previous iterations through referendum an increased sales tax, but not like this, not structured like this. The majority of these funds would go to address our pension obligation. And I just don't see the electorate embracing an increase in taxation to pay off or to pay down debts incurred before many of the voters were alive, and to people that, you know, they're owed their pension, but many of whom do not live in Milwaukee anymore. So I have very serious concerns that a referendum would not be successful. I also have confidence in the people that I elect locally to the city council and to the county board. I think that they should be able to make that decision. And we have 68 of 72 counties in Wisconsin that have enacted a local 0.5% sales tax. We do that through enabling legislation to have the county board make that choice, not a referendum. We have communities that have increased sales tax for tourism, like the Wisconsin Dells. They do that through enabling legislation, not through referendum. So that the legislature giving local sales tax authority has not required a referendum. And I think in this instance, to ensure that we get this done and ensure that we have these revenues and help Milwaukee County and the city out, that we do it through enabling legislation.
Let's turn now to the pay of public defenders and the justice system. Joint Finance Committee Republicans recently approved a measure that would increase hourly wages for assistant district attorneys and public defenders. Does this wage plan provide enough support to the state's criminal justice workforce?
Well, I would first mention that it was a 16-0 vote. We had all Democrats and Republicans agreeing that our justice system actors desperately need more bodies in the system to handle cases, and those individuals that are working in that capacity need a raise. Over the weekend, I heard from a number of friends that I was a public defender in Milwaukee County, and I'm still very close with a number of lawyers in that system, and they reported directly to me that it was a godsend, or it will be, and that it's desperately needed. I think morale took a huge boost in the prosecutor and public defender offices. So time will tell if this is enough. One of the points that Democrats made in the committee, where we will have to come back and address, is the additional support staff for prosecutors and public defenders. And that will be necessary as technology and science changes. The type of evidence that the criminal justice system uses is changing and becoming more complex. That takes the form in things like body camera evidence that people have to watch that can be hours and hours and hours, and forensic science and the type of evidence available in cases becomes more complex. So we need to, this was a great first step. We have to pay people, we have to attract and retain good quality lawyers, but we also need to support them with people underneath them to help them process the cases in a timely fashion.
We have Milwaukee Representative Evan Gwaike, Democratic member of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee. Share your thoughts on the two-year budget. Call in with questions, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We check in on developments in the state budget negotiations at the Capitol with a member of the legislature's influential Budget Writing Committee. Still time to share how you feel? Call in with a question, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Democratic State Representative Evan Gwaike of Milwaukee is here. Representative Gwaike, you mentioned at the top that May started with a flurry from Joint Finance Committee. And indeed, earlier this month, Republicans on the committee voted to reject more than 500 items from the proposed budget Governor Evers had put forward. Which key measures were removed?
Well, I'll touch on a few that will be relevant to this week's debate. Tomorrow, in the Department of Workforce Development debate, we should be talking about paid family leave. The governor had proposed creating a program that would function similar to unemployment compensation, where workers and employers would pay into what is essentially an insurance policy for when individuals need paid leave for the birth of a child or an aging parent or an illness. And that was unfortunately removed. It's a policy that we know would benefit tens of thousands of working people in Wisconsin. Similarly, this week we debate the Higher Education AIDS Board, and there are provisions that the governor had proposed to help keep tuition down or free, especially for low-income families in Wisconsin. And we know that there is that providing those incentives for students seeking higher education that come from families that can't pay for college, it's a huge incentive for them to go to get trained, to get an education. And, you know, we have huge challenges in our workforce, especially in places like nursing and education. And, you know, these we think are worthy investments to address that pipeline and put more people in the path to those careers.
So with those types of items off the table, what are the ulterior priorities in the area of workforce development?
Well, I'll tell you, there are more items that the Republicans removed than they are adding. So the Department of Workforce Development in tomorrow's debate is a relatively thin debate. We'll see. They have the opportunity. Just because they were removed doesn't mean items can't be put back in. There is a program called the Fast Forward, which is a grant program to employers to help train and skill up their current employees. And I imagine Republicans will put some additional dollars into that fund. They have done that over the years. It's something that, of course, we support. The governor's recommended adding dollars in that area. But what really will define tomorrow's debate is what we're not debating, which is far larger and more impactful than the policies that we will debate.
What is the impact of Republicans working from base budget and not from the governor's budget document and its proposals?
Yeah, this is a great question, and it gets a little insidery and a little in the weeds, but it's very important because I know that many people listening are passionate about, and advocate and call and email their legislator. What that means is, in order for a new pot of money to be added or a program to be expanded, it will take a proactive majority vote of the Joint Finance Committee. Whereas had we worked off of the governor's budget, it would have taken a proactive majority vote of the committee to not fund that new initiative. And so it seems like a technical change, but what it means is if the committee does not take action on a certain item, that item is not in the budget. So as listeners follow along, it's very important to plug into these hearings to make sure what is added. Because if you're advocating for that thing, if you're adding for postpartum coverage of Medicaid to be expanded, that has to actually be voted on by the committee proactively in a motion in joint finance.
Let's turn now to the historic surplus. We saw the Legislative Fiscal Bureau publishing a slight downward revision on state tax collections last week. And the co-chairs of Joint Finance, Senator Mark Lyne and Representative Bourne, they reacted using the words cautious budget. What do the Bureau's latest estimates mean to you?
Well, in the text of the Bureau's report, there is a sentence that the co-chairs failed to acknowledge, which is that by most economic indicators, 2023 will not be facing a recession, despite my Republican colleagues claiming that for the last 2 years or so. So it is a downward projection. A lot of that is due to the end of the emergency or health emergency declared at the federal level. I don't think it's a time to return to austerity budgeting, with that still closing a budget with nearly $7 billion. I think I lost internet signal, so let's do some broadband expansion and enhancement with some of that one-time money. We have not yet debated the state's capital budget. I can tell you that every single University of Wisconsin campus has tremendous needs and needs investment. The governor has suggested investing nearly $2 billion of one-time money into building projects. That would save us hundreds of millions of dollars over the next couple of decades. So I'm still bullish. I think that there still needs to be investment, and you know, that downward notch of the estimate also came with some other positive economic indicators underneath it. So I do not think it's doom and gloom. I think this should remain a growth budget, and we need to invest this surplus appropriately, but it needs to be invested.
Talking about state budget negotiations with Representative Evan Goyke, Democratic member of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee. You can join in along the way. Call in with the question at 800-642-1234. Representative Goyke, you said this is for the June debates, but what comes with the taxes, and you know, where might we see tax cuts? Republicans want to move toward a flat income tax, which was a topic of conversation earlier this year. Governor Evers proposing tax cuts targeting the middle class. What tax cuts are you seeking?
Yes, the governor's proposed a 10% tax cut for middle class income earners, individuals making $100,000 or less, or married couples making $150,000 or less. I expect the tax debate to be pushed towards the very end of the budget. There are very, very big disagreements between Senate Republicans, who remain very focused on flattening the income brackets and buying down that top income tax bracket to benefit the wealthiest individuals, and Assembly Republicans, who seem to be somewhere but yet nowhere. They have not really articulated what their posture is, and there's big tension behind the scenes. The Republicans don't necessarily invite me into all of their closed door meetings, but I pick up in talking to them here and there that this is going to be a source of big division and disagreement between the two Republican caucuses. And in the meantime, I think Democrats are rallying behind the governor's plan that we can afford, that brings tax relief to the people that need it the most, you know, this kind of middle-class income earners. And I don't see any reason why we need to fight. We can just agree with the governor's plan and move forward.
Very quickly, about 10 seconds here, what key votes are coming this week? What should we watch for in the coming days?
Again, lots of workforce development, labor, higher education, technical colleges, the Department of Revenue on Thursday, which is critical. So lots happening this week and every week in the next 6 weeks or so.
Representative Goyke, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. My pleasure.
Evan Goyke, Democratic State Representative from Milwaukee, member of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee, first elected to the Assembly in 2012. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.